And is currently taking time out earning money. That'll change. Working for a hedge fund.
Why is this on?
Sounds like.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. Clark and Spector at Marlow Park. And
you can put that in your pocket, please.
If I can.
We have a point here also, an archivist thing somewhere.
Oh, really? Thank you. Okay, so the problem we're addressing, although not really solving, is that our traditional formulation, when people can talk about this, you start by noticing that the laws of physics are almost universal symmetric. Almost in the sense that they all, so far as we know, at least in their standard formulation, admit symmetries that reverse the direction of time. They may do other things as well. That's at least one thing they do. And that throws two puzzles in your way. One is that if you're given some non-maximal, non-equilibrium entropy at a given time, why is it larger at later times and smaller at earlier times? And not the other way around. Where does the asymmetry come from? And the second problem is that if you assume you have a solution to the first one, so you're happy that there's this decreasing entropy gradient into the past, why was the initial entropy so low to begin with? So you can look at an egg being converted into an omelet as an example of raising entropy. And the first problem is really the question of why the arrow is there, why that happens in one direction and one in the other direction. And the second problem is the question of where the egg came from in the first place. There's a lot to say about how to think about these, so let's think about the first problem for a moment. The first reaction you might have to it is that it isn't true. If you take any of these theories and you take a state that has non-equilibrium entropy, it isn't true that all states like that will have higher entropy in the future. And you can see that just by taking one that does have higher entropy in the future and time reversing it, and that state will have lower entropy in the future. Well, sorry, you can take one that has a lower entropy in the past and time reverse it, and that will have lower entropy in the future. So, and there are lots of things you can do at this point. Here are two particular options, although there are plenty of other approaches you can take. One is you can restrict yourself to looking at some physically motivated subset of states with that entropy. And this is the approach that Boltzmann tries to take. And for reasons I can get into, if you're interested, it is the wrong approach. Mainly because it's extremely difficult to find a criterion which encapsulates the correct set of states we're interested in. Maybe I'll just say about why that is. So the H theory, which is Boltzmann's attempt to derive the entropy gradient, uses an assumption that we now call the molecular chaos assumption, which is more or less the assumption that at a given position, the velocities of different particles there are uncorrelated. There are some generalizations that one can consider this, but that's the basic assumption. And the important point is that, indeed, if you assume that, then you can show that the entropy of those states will increase into the future. But the thing is, that fact being satisfying vector chaos is a time-reversible fact. If you reverse the directions of the velocities of particles, they'll still be uncorrelated with one another. So what you show is that, in fact, for a state satisfying vector chaos, entropy decreases both into the future and, entropy increases, sorry, both into the future and into the past. So if you classify states of a given entropy into four types, like this, basically looking at whether the entropy was bigger or smaller in the past and in the future, those that satisfy molecular chaos are of type 1. Type 2 and type 3 are related by the time reversal symmetry. But the second law is a statement about types 3 and type 4. We happen to know that the entropy was lower in the past. So the statement that the entropy will rise is a statement that we're much more likely to be in a state of type 3 than we are to be in a state of type 4. It has nothing at all to do with states of type 1. So there are various generalizations of molecular chaos one can consider. So I don't want to rule out totally this approach. The most standard approach to it, I don't think, works at all. Another approach which does rather better is to choose a probability measure over the states with some low entropy at some early time, and then just hypothesize that we are typical with respect to that probability distribution. This problem one is not what I'm going to spend most of the time talking about. It's really an introduction to the second problem, which is, given that we're happy that there's a decreasing entropy gradient into the past, why was the initial entropy so low? And I mean, my first reaction to this is to wonder, you know, is there really any problem here at all? There really isn't any reason to think that low entropy initial conditions are unlikely. Although it's true that if you consider a thermal bath and you look at fluctuations away from equilibrium, then fluctuations to lower entropy are exponentially less likely than fluctuations to higher entropy, there's no reason to think the universe was in equilibrium at some early time and that it came about as a fluctuation. So it isn't right to say that it's unlikely. But nevertheless, low entropy initial conditions are a feature of the world that we want to understand better. And the analogy I like to think of is, if you think of there being three generations of particles in the standard model, there's no reason to think that three is an unlikely number. But if anyone comes up with a good reason or insight into why there aren't three, that's still something that can be huge progress. Okay. So how is the low entropy manifest in the early universe? It's manifest by the fact that the state in the early universe was extremely homogeneous. And for a gravitational system that is low entropy, almost all states like that clump up. And if you take clump states, they have to be very, very finely tuned and very special in order that they'll smooth back out, which attracts a force from the present. So the canonical example we like to think of as a gas in a box. On the left is the equilibrium state without gravity, and on the right is what happens when you switch gravity on.
But even for the box, there is a critical size of the box, that if the box is, well, compared to the temperature, so if the box is smaller than the Jeans length of the gas, then that's not much.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that would be important later on. It's not just a question of whether there is or there isn't gravity. You're absolutely right, the Jeans length is sufficiently
large. How do you know that the universe is homogeneous at T equals 0?
Sorry,
how do you know the universe is homogeneous? Time will go to zero.
I was thinking of looking at cosmic microwave background measurements.
But that's at the surface of Earth's crust.
That's true. So we don't know.
400,000 years after so-called Big Bang.
That's almost zero by cosmological.
Well, almost zero is not zero.
It's absolutely true. We don't know. But this is the earliest that we do know about. But we don't have any fun experimental information.
I'm glad to see it.
Absolutely right. So a common claim, which I want to argue against, is that inflation provides a natural solution to this problem. It naturally explains why the universe is smooth. And I'll just say the problem straight away is that inflation itself requires very special initial conditions to start. And in the simplest case, as far as in a single scalar field, the condition is that the scalar field itself has to be smooth. And you can see that from looking at this requirement for there to be acceleration. And what's required in order for that to be negative is that the potential be much larger than the kinetic energy terms. And that's guaranteed if the field happens to be very smooth in space. So inflation, in a sense, passes the buck from the smoothness problem to the inflaton field. You sometimes hear that the solution to this is chaotic inflation. So the idea there, as far as I understand it, is that when you think of the inflaton field as being in a thermal bath, essentially, of its own making, and every now and again there's a fluctuation, and this wildly oscillating field just happens by chance to produce a particularly smooth patch, and that part inflates. Maybe someone can explain to me what I'm missing here, but there are a number of attempts, and these arguments go back to Boltzmann, at least, to try and think of the universe as arising from fluctuation from thermal bath. And the problem with those is that the most likely fluctuations from thermal bath are those which have just low enough entropy to reproduce our experience and no lower. And those that have much lower entropy are exponentially less likely. So if you look out in the universe and you see things which are much, whose entropy is far lower than would be required to produce us, that in a sense falsifies the hypothesis that we came about from fluctuation. And this strikes me as being rather similar. The size of the smooth patch that originates by chance is vastly more likely to be too small to produce the universe as large as we see. But I could well be missing something, so I have to be educated otherwise. So the idea that we try to explore is a different way to approach smoothness in the early universe. We start off by noting that in the absence of attractive forces, smooth initial conditions are equilibrium states, just like an ordinary gas in a box. So the idea is to engineer a situation where we have a phase transition in the early universe from gravity being very weak to gravity being very strong. The idea then is that the universe starts out in a homogeneous state, and that's natural for a system with only weak attractive forces. Immediately after the phase transition, the universe will still be homogeneous, but it won't any longer be in equilibrium. So that's the idea. Here's what a rough idea of the picture is supposed to look like in phase space. So this first sheet over here is the sheet that we start out on, the early universe. And this large circle here is smooth, homogeneous states. And it's large because those are the equilibrium states on that sheet. When the phase transition happens, suddenly, intuitively, I guess one can think that matter suddenly acquires potential energy because it's suddenly subject to gravitational attraction. And that puts it on a totally different energy slice through the phase space. Wholly different states are now accessible to it. So the relevant partitioning of phase space is now different. And in fact, it then finds itself in a rather low entropy region of phase space, and it from there evolves to lumpy states, which are in this gravitational slice, they have high entropy. So this is roughly how the picture is supposed to look in phase space. And you can see that you start out in an equilibrium state and you end up in one too. So what we did was we found a toy model wherein we think an idea like this is realized. And the way it works is to promote, sorry, Newton, not Newton. Newton's constant.
Sorry, can you go back to the picture?
Sure.
Okay. So this the whole volume is the phase space.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you had the subspace of the equilibrium configuration.
No, before you do that, you have to restrict to an energy hypersurface. And then on that energy hypersurface, you have a subspace of equilibrium configurations.
And that's, and there is that? That's what, the circle, or that's the...
Sorry, that's the large circle.
That's
the large circle,
and
yeah.
All of them somehow maximize the entropy?
For that hypersurface.
For that
hypersurface. And with those dynamics, which restricted to that hypersurface.
Is there a small circle goes to phase transition?
Yeah, I mean, every point in this big surface will have a different small circle and will go to a different phase space. The reason that happens is because when you turn on gravity, if you start out with a homogeneous system, the system becomes extremely unstable. Because what starts out as macroscopically indistinguishable configurations, different equilibrium states of the gas, if you let them clump, suddenly become distinguishable. So they're actually...
What happens, what causes the phase transition?
It'll depend on the model, but I'm now going to get to a toy model where we'll see what works. So The idea to create the structure is to promote Newton's constant to a dynamical field, phi, and look at a Brown-Zwicky type theory. And the idea will be that the expectation value of this function, f of phi, which I'll specify in a minute, is what corresponds, you know, gives you the effect of Newton's constant in this theory. Now, to see the way that phi is going to behave, what one should do really is a conformal transformation on the metric to move this Einstein frame and the potential that results with phi will govern the behavior of phi. So what we're going to do, what we do is we choose the functions f, g, and u so that the Einstein frame potential, which I'll show in a minute, has the properties we want. It'll have one unstable extremum with a small effective Newton's constant, and it'll have one minimum with a large effective Newton's constant, so that you know, the phi equals lambda and phi equals zero, I'll arrange it. And then the idea is that the phase transition is the expectation value of phi going from the unstable to the stable vacuum. So the model that we look at is this one. So f, g, and u are given by these functions. It looks slightly strange that g is zero, because it seems to eliminate the kinetic term for phi, but it actually doesn't, because when one does the conformal transformation on the metric, one multiplies the metric by a function of phi, and the curvature tensor actually regenerates the kinetic term. So it's still there. And that just shows you how difficult it is to see the physics by looking at this action. Okay. C and lambda are arbitrary constants for the moment. But the point is that the ratio of the effective Newton's constants in the two vacua are given by that function, 2 plus 2 c lambda. So what we have is we have parametric control over the extent to which the strength of gravity increases.
So when you say vacuum, there are two minima for or two extrema for the potential?
Yes, exactly. Here it is. So this is transforming to Einstein frame. And those functions before were chosen precisely so as to ensure these properties of this potential V, that it has an unstable maximum at lambda, and it has a stable minimum at zero. So the idea is it's going to roll down. And it behaves exactly as you'd expect. You can put in sample initial conditions, and you'll see that phi indeed rolls down, and you can see that the effect of Newton's constant jumps up by a factor of 2c lambda. So
this is a generalization of Jordan Feinstein.
I think it's actually a special case of Feinstein.
It's a special case.
Yeah.
Potential.
Sorry?
With a potential.
Yes.
The original Feinstein theory didn't have a potential.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
61. 96.
Okay. Yeah, it's Feinstein with potential. So a few things to say about how to interpret this. The problem is that it's very easy to accidentally assume the things you're trying to show when we're discussing natural initial conditions. So here are some potential difficulties. The simulations we did assumed that the scalar field phi was homogeneous, and that was precisely the criticism we had of inflation.
For the phase transition, also you're doing all of this at zero temperature. Should you be possible to do this at high temperature?
So this is more or less the same thing, right? Because if I add excitations of phi, I can imagine putting it in a thermal bar. I can imagine doing a variety of things with it. I guess I intend this criticism to cover phi
too. Phi is just the gravitational constant, of course.
Its expectation value gives the gravitational constant.
So it's not the same as the inverse.
No, not at all.
People try to do inflation with this stuff.
Have they?
Some 15 years ago.
Okay.
And it didn't work. That's beside the point.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is really just a toy model. I'm certainly not. This isn't intended at all as a criticism of inflation either. It's just a toy model about this particular idea about swing initial conditions. There are many other reasons why one should be interested in inflation. So please don't take this as a criticism of inflation models. But the point is, one criticism that one makes of inflation seems to apply here as well, because we assume that the field is smooth. But I don't think it applies with the same force. And the reason is that inflation requires that the field to be smooth in order to get an acceleration at all. Whereas nothing about this scenario requires the field to be homogeneous. That's a calculational convenience, because it's rather difficult. I think it's rather difficult to track the full dynamics of the field of flight. Another difficulty is that the action that we use is pretty contrived from the point of view of quantum field theory. We've arbitrarily set terms to zero that are the same order as terms we don't set to zero for no good reason involving symmetries. And one in general expects higher order terms that will change the vacuum structure totally. And I think we just have to admit that the aim here wasn't to solve problems of fine tuning and branching, but rather to see what can expect in initial conditions. So if you like, you can think of this as an exchange into the problem of swing initial conditions with the problem of fine-tuning and branching.
So I think that's a bit troubling, is that G is a dimension for quantity. So G large and G small doesn't really make much sense. It's just especially at different times. So you need a dimensionless quantity, that if it's small, then it can be lead to homogeneity. If it's large, then it's good. And I struggle to find what that dimensionless quantity is here.
So that's a very good question. We think what it is, it's the ratio between the gene's length and the Hubble length.
The gene's length and the Hubble length.
But I don't have a fantastic answer for that. But yeah, it relates to your earlier question. That you know, when you say the gas is going to collapse, you need to, you know, that's true if the gene's length is exceeded by the body, or if any particular whole body.
But I mean, in radiation era, that's always of order one. So I'm not sure, what does that mean? Is it easy to, is the universe homogeneous because of that or not?
Well, I mean, the radiation era is supposed to take place after this.
After this.
So yeah. We're happy to set the initial Hubble volume to whatever is required. That's the next work.
You can divide phi by G nu. That's the dimension.
But G Newton is irrelevant. Today's G Newton is
why would the G Newton?
Yeah, but I mean, today's G Newton is irrelevant for early universe. It's just
You still have to use G Newton to do calculations.
I guess the question is if there's some initial Hubble volume.
Yeah.
And the question is, are the stable states, are the equilibrium states of that Hubble volume homogeneous or not? And that question, the answer to that depends on the ratio between the gene length and the Hubble volume.
I'm not sure what it means, because if you have a Hubble volume, that means that you have expansion. If you have an expansion, it means that you're not in equilibrium.
Why not? I mean,
but you might have local equilibrium, yeah. But globally, you're not in equilibrium, right? Because you have expansion. Otherwise, something is changing, right?
Well, but in the way that one can imagine traversing around equilibrium states in phase space.
Yeah. That might be discussed.
Okay. So just to summarize, smooth states of gravitational systems have low entropy. And the idea is that by engineering gravity to be very weak at early times, we can give a smooth initial state a high equilibrium entropy. And this changes our perspective on the homogeneity of our universe because it's now natural to have smooth initial conditions with respect to the dynamics that were functioning at other times, whereas ordinarily we think it was being highly unnatural. And scalars has a very wider class of models. And I want to finish by saying that we initially thought of weakening gravity for this purpose, but the more we thought about it, it seems like there could be other interesting consequences of allowing the strength of gravity to vary across space as well as across time. And in particular, we could imagine asking what if Newton's constant could be made to depend on the local matter density, something like the way the couplings of the chameleon field do. And you might wonder whether you could resolve the black hole singularity without the quantum gravity at all. And what I have in mind is that if you imagine a neutron star collapsing, the density getting higher and higher in the center, ordinarily when the horizon is outside, in the gravitational collapse. But if the strength of gravity weakens where the density is very high, then you can imagine a scenario where the singularity is just smoothed out. You have a space-time where there is a horizon. But inside the horizon is something like a supermassive neutron star, which can exist because in its interior, the strength of gravity is weak. So that's just the speculative idea, but that's what we're looking at.
So, when this phase transition happens everywhere at the same time, and
that's a good question. Yeah, it's not a bubble mutation. It's just a rolling of the expectation.
Because the other thing that they thought is that could you produce topological defect?
We thought about that initially, actually, but we didn't pursue a timing model. I don't know. That's a good question.
So, about this black hole singularity, I thought that for this transdicking theories, there are no Hare theorems similar to those in EGR that says that basically you only have. Kind of a black hole, essentially nothing else. Maybe somebody else not remember this. But if the only thing you're looking at are Rand-Stickey theories or skeletons theories, I believe there are no Hare theorems that basically tell you there must be a singularity.
Those are vacuum solutions?
Well,
so this would not be a vacuum solution.
It depends on whether you can qualify vacuum. Well, no, so it's not vacuum anymore because they have five
here. No, there would also be other matter coupling to both five and G, which
is saying you have other matter.
Yeah.
But it's still, the matter satisfies the energy conditions that are necessary for the singularity. Because you can always go to the Einstein frame, then you just have a scalar field that's coupled to matter, right? And the question is, does matter, does that mixture of a scalar field plus matter, does it satisfy the conditions for a singularity? I don't remember, is it rho plus p larger than zero or something?
I'm not sure.
So, if it does, then you still have to expect a singularity.
But they didn't. First thing, they didn't have g equal to zero, r equal to zero.
But it's not it's never exactly zero, it's always some finite number, right? But the thing is, you can go to the Einstein frame, and in the Einstein frame, G is constant. You just have some funny coupling of a scalar group matter.
Yeah. The Einstein frame, the fishing is very
perfect.
Well, Parker's not going to do the long-term test.
In Einstein.
So I only used the Jordan Brand sticky frame, because Parker's not going to do the long-term test.
In that sense, that's true. But So you have a complicated matter, but you have a general theorem that tells as long as rho plus p for that complicated matter is larger than zero, then you form a singular.
Because g and u is constant, that's been framed, and horrible things happening. It's not a much translating the difference in the physics. Joel is trying to speak, it's a very horrible situation. That's been
I agree.
What you're saying is doesn't follow. So the whole issue of having singularities and modified gravity, this is what we have. It's not resolved. Still a lot of work to do. I've been working on this.
But the question is, my question is, to what extent is this modified gravity? Because if you go to the Einstein frame, it's just Einstein gravity from some weird matter. And as long as that weird matter satisfies the conditions.
Why are these equivalence? The physics is very
no, but everything violates. I mean, you and I violate the equivalence principle because we are interacting with the chairs of the
physics. But you don't violate the equivalence
principle.
Okay. I just want to find out that. Yes, I have things. Earlier this year, I published a paper on classical quantum gravity with a modified gravity field, the vector field classical. And it gives this picture. You find that if you solve the equations, you do get a phase transition, T. You get a low entropy of T to zero. There's a balance, there's no singularity. This is something you have to worry about. Well, there's a singularity T to zero.
That's why I'm using the reference.
Any more questions? Okay, well, let's thank Simon for being short on.